Ambrose was used in a mighty way in preserving the empire as a whole. In 393, when the Gothic warlord Arbogastes murdered the emperor, decreed the destruction of Christianity. And Ambrose rallied many cities against the barbarians and sent them off to fight in the army of Emperor-elect Theodosius. Theodosius was victorious, virtually eliminating paganism from the Roman Empire. Ambrose was a personal counselor to several Roman emperors. Through the preaching of truth and involvement in the lives of political figures, Ambrose was intimately involved in seeing Arianism defeated throughout the Western Empire. And so, as Mark was saying earlier, the Arianism had kind of begun in the East, but it sounds like it had really taken root in the West and really was the in vogue thing. And Ambrose was very much a part of I mean, I read quite a number of the larger books that he wrote. They're in the volumes upstairs, and he was just always blasting the Arians. You know, he was almost vicious against them. And you know, you guys say this, but how can it be that and this? And just using a lawyer's mind, I was really impressed. He was using a lawyer's mind to show the Arians their faults. So I didn't. This is probably not a very good summary, but I tried to summarize God's use of the Bishop Ambrose. Through the service of this great man, God accomplished his purposes in building and preserving his bride, the church, from the heresy of Arianism. Through his piety and virtue, this man demonstrated what it means to be surrendered to Christ. He influenced those who came in contact with him by practicing what he preached and passed along his teaching and life to Augustine. This man is a little known link. There's, you know, I've shared a little bit, but it doesn't sound like there's a lot of for sure facts about what kind of, you know, we've been able to find out a lot through his writings, but this man is definitely a link in training up Augustine to be the man that he was. And it kind of went over my head, but there was one guy in particular that was making the point that Ambrose was understanding some theological points and was making a shift in theology from what was typically Eastern. And he didn't say much about it, but that it was that theology that Augustine built on. I need to do some more work on that, but I was really impressed with the way that this man's teaching was the foundation that Augustine built on, and also his life. Again, he practiced what he preached, and the thing that really drew Augustine to Christ and really caused him to be the man in terms of as a teacher as that he was this man Ambrose. It sounds like Augustine kind of came to Milan, you know, just kind of hanging out, and he was involved in some other cults and wasn't real sure what he believed and everything. And I think I'm right in this. Ambrose kind of took him in to his home and showed him hospitality, and he became a Christian and began so this man was a vitally important link to who Augustine was, who would go on to do some great things and write some great writings. So I guess that's kind of Ambrose through a snapshot of him. Are there any questions?
Did you read about the time when Theodosius was almost excommunicated by Ambrose?
Yes, I did, and I don't think I mentioned that in here. That was another significant event that a lot of people talk about is in Thessalonica. It sounds like there was an uprising, a riot in Thessalonica, and there were state officials killed, and Theodosius sent in the army, and they basically slaughtered 7,000 just regular citizens in the city of Thessalonica. And Ambrose really said, man, you're off in left field. You know, you are doing, this is wrong. If you don't publicly confess to this, you know, we're going to excommunicate you. And really, he was a man who took a strong stand in several different cases against, things that were going on in the government, and really was fearless and bold in that. And Theodosius did wind up repenting, I guess, and wound up, according to a couple places I read, wound up dying in Ambrose's arms, which I thought was really a neat picture. I didn't get a good feel for it, but it sounded like he was kind of a confidant to at least a couple of the emperors and had some, was involved in maybe not politics, but was certainly involved in the lives of the men who were involved in the politics of that day. So it was a neat example to me of how a man can be used in the state, how man can then go on to be used in the church, and God can use him in both of those places. Yeah, Mike?
I read Confessions by Augustine's own autobiography, and he has a picture of Ambrose that would be pretty neat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he talks about what Ambrose did in his life and how God was changing his heart to Christ through the preaching of Ambrose and what his example stuff. So all that stuff about him being an influence on, you can read it from his own words.
That's neat. Yeah, I had some excerpts, but I didn't have time to find it all the way. That's neat. Thanks.
Thank you, Brad. I don't know what we're going to, how we're going to penalize people who are late with their papers, but what do we do with somebody that's that much ahead with the papers? Thank you. Thank you. I have here what Russ has given me this evening, a little booklet on Augustine, the farmer's boy. Augustine here. I read that. It's an excellent review of Augustine's life. Please do get that reviewed before Donald Cassell gets in here and starts asking us, giving us an oral quiz. This one here is The Odyssey of Athanasius Against the World. Remember, that was the whole world is against you, Athanasius, and then Athanasius simply responded by saying, then Athanasius is against the whole world. These are excellent little books and ones that would be well to put in your library, because they will summarize so many of the things that are coming to life here just now. When you read something like this, it brings a lot of loose ends together. Let me encourage you to get these and put them in your own library. Then you can have them to refer back to later on. Tom?
How much money and who do we pay?
They are, the price is on there. This one is $7 on Augustine, and this one is $8 on Athanasius. And I'm sure that Russ has advanced these or put them on consignment or something, and just leave the money there on the table if you would like to take one home with you this evening. Thank you. Thank you very much. Last week, I had summarized situation for the Christian church by quoting to you from the Epistle to Diognetus, and what were these Christian communities and Christian peoples? Before we start this, let me put that map back up there one more time, please. And the maps that you have may not show the shaded areas as well as this one does. But if you look carefully, you'll see it. And you see how the church is expanding out of Jerusalem to Antioch. See the shaded area around Antioch and even up around Tarsus. This is an indication of how the church is expanding. And it's moving on. If you remember, Paul and Barnabas went across to Cyprus, and then they made that first missionary journey up through Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, the churches of Galatia. And not to begin with, but they went up and across into Philippi, and Thessalonica, and then down to Corinth. And you see the shaded areas growing, and then back again to Jerusalem. And then Paul went out the next time and went to Rome and to Milan was not far from there. He was desiring, of course, to go on out into Spain. And we're reading now about these places here, Lyons, Vienne, Milan. Is that out of focus? Is it just my... Milan, Vienne, Lyons, Lyon, Toledo, Cordoba, and Hippo. Who was it, Hippo?
Augustine.
Carthage. That shows up in several of the men that we're talking with now. The black part is the water part. Syracuse was important. Back here to Corinth. This is the way the gospel is moving. Here's Edessa up here. This is the way that the gospel is moving out. This was where Constantine was when his troops declared on the death of the emperor that he would be emperor. And so it was a long march from here all the way down into Italy, just outside Rome there, where he won that battle over his chief adversary, and then went on to become the emperor. Keep this kind of a map in mind. That's why we've given you a copy of it. You may have other maps there. Also, keep bringing your timeline up to date. But we need also to get some picture of what's going on behind the scenes and at the grassroots of the Christian community. Remember, Jesus talked about how the tree one of his pictures of how his kingdom would grow and how the church would grow was of the external growth of a tree. And then the other one was the internal growth of the mustard or of the yeast. And we're talking a little bit now about what was going on behind the scenes underneath the surface. I quoted to you last time from that one letter, one description that had been made by Diognetus. And I want to go on to give you some other quotes from some of the other church leaders. Clement said that the Christians of this period saw themselves as a separated people, a new race. I'm quoting from him. The true Israel, whose citizenship was no longer in the Roman Empire, although they prayed for Rome and for the emperor. Would this make it easier for them to endure the persecution or harder if they did not consider their citizenship to be in Rome, but above Rome, in a different nation? They are the church. And I was very much interested in one of the phrases that Clement used there, which was created before the sun and the moon. The origin of the church. Lamb slain before the foundation of the world.
Is that Clement of Rome or Clement of Alexandria?
Clement of Rome. Clement of Rome. And they believed that it was for the sake of the church that everything else had been created. Remind you of any scripture? He has made head over all things to the church. Didn't say the church was head over all things. But said that, nevertheless, for the sake of the church, everything else had been created. That does not mean that the church is over everything else. The Shepherd of Hermas echoes the same theology of the origin of the church. They both saw the church as not just a gathering of people on earth that are reaching up towards heaven in praise and prayer and so forth. They saw the church as something of heaven itself reaching down to embrace all believers and to gather them into the fellowship of heaven from wherever they are scattered all over the world. There's a shocking contrast between that and the idea that we have so prevalent today, that the church is made up of people who just sort of see they have a particular need and that the church can meet that need better than anyone else, so they gather themselves together. I hope you're catching the distinction there, because those are two different ideas about the origin of the church. These men were seeing the church as a fellowship of heaven that was reaching down to incorporate believers on earth and bring them to into the fellowship of heaven itself. The believer is admitted to this church by baptism because, as one of these men said, it is builded upon waters. It is builded upon waters. And Justin Martyr insisted in his apology that this baptism must be accompanied by a profession of faith and repentance, either by the adult or by parents. Services of worship were held on the Lord's Day, the day He rose from the dead. And they called it the Lord's Day. A little bit later on, we're going to see some syncretism come in here of where one of the emperors, who was a worshiper of the sun, decreed that they would worship God on the Sunday. You may begin to see in this a reason why I don't like the use the word Sunday. And in the bulletins, we'll do anything else. Sometimes we'll call it the Sabbath. Sometimes we'll call it the Lord's Day. But why worship God on the day of the worship of the sun god? Meetings for reading of the scriptures. The two kinds of meetings. For the reading of the scriptures involving preaching, involving singing, involving prayer, and then a common evening meal, which was followed by the Lord's Supper. Although by the time of Justin Martyr, when he wrote his apology, the common meal, at least in Rome, was dropped, and the earlier service was followed by the sacrament, that is, the morning service. And then there were the offerings for the needy that were made in connection with the sacrament. The offerings were made in connection with the sacrament. As God gave of Himself to them, they gave of themselves to others. Wednesday and Friday were fast days, which were called stations. And that was the same word that was used for soldiers who were on guard around a given area. Stations. And the fast days were called stations. They prayed the Lord's Prayer three times a day. Fasting was better than praying, but almsgiving was better than fasting or praying. And second marriages, for any reason, were discouraged. Who was it was telling his wife he wouldn't marry, or there wouldn't be a second marriage? That was you, right? Simple repentance needed to be followed up with restitution, penance, in order to be genuine. And Christians could and therefore should do more than God demanded. And that's where they began maybe getting into some trouble, works of supererogation, bonus works, to make God love them a little bit more than He already did. There was an amazing generosity in the early church, especially in the church in Rome. The poor, widows, and orphans were cared for. Some men sold themselves into slavery in order to be able to help the poor more. Congregations gave to other congregations far away from them. Those in the eastern end of the Mediterranean would be giving to support and encourage and help those in the in Spain and in France and in Gaul. Many people were slow to free their slaves because, and they had it well reasoned out, that the slaves would fail because of poverty. They didn't have any way of earning a living, and so they would fail, they would be taken into temptation, and so they held them on as slaves, but they did not treat them as slaves. Idols were a continuing problem for people who had been so recently released from idolatry. And the very idea that idols were gods, they saw them as demons. Justin tells us that the early Christians looked at those idols as those old idols that they now knew were nothing more than a piece of stone or a piece of metal or a piece of wood. They knew they weren't anything, but they saw them as being demons. And early Christians explained any similarity between what they were doing in the worship of the true God and idol worship as being a parody of demons. That the demons would make that perverted worship to be like what the genuine worship of God actually is. Early Christians feared the influence of demons, and there was much genuine exorcism in the name of Christ. Spiritual warfare was very, very real for them, as it was real for Paul. This was the Christianity. This was the church that Christ is building during this period. And it conquered the Roman Empire and the philosophies and the paganism of its day. Now I want to say a little bit more about organization, the organization of this church. The organization did not take place all at once. There was a gradual development, and it was not the same in any given area. Churches in Asia Minor and Ephesus over seemed to become organized far more quickly and far earlier than those in Rome, for example. It was a long time before Rome had any bishop. When Justin Martyr got there, apparently there wasn't a bishop, although he called himself the bishop. And he'd been in touch with Polycarp that he called the bishop. But by the middle of the second century, there was a real similarity and a strength in the organizations. The Jewish Christian churches, especially those at the other end of the Mediterranean Sea, seem to have had a head start on all the others, probably because of their experiences with the elders in the Old Testament. You remember God had directed Moses in the appointment of elders, the election of elders, and there was a very strong organization of the temple there in Jerusalem. The priests and the Levites and the scribes and the Pharisees in the early New Testament times, development of the synagogues, wherever there were 10 responsible men, they could form a new synagogue. And we were just talking about it at the break time here. I remember on the airplane on the way over to Israel last summer, there were a group of 10 men, and at a particular point, those 10 men put their shawls on and got together in a little huddle in the airplane there and began reading that book. And they had their service right there. And Brad was saying after we were talking about it here, as he talked to some of the men after, they didn't understand a thing of what they'd been doing. But nevertheless, this was just built into them. And so we would find this kind of thing going on any place where there had been any of the synagogues, and the Jews knew how this worked. I was working with a group of men who had very little experience with the Presbyterian, in fact, no experience with the Presbyterian form of government the other day, and they were wanting to know how they could evaluate counselors for the ministry that we were talking about. People who were wanting to become counselors. And so I found myself explaining to them about what we do in presbytery meeting when we evaluate a man who is taken under care to become a student of theology, to let others who are in the ministry and who've been in the ministry for a time see if God can use this man in the type of ministry that God has called them to and that they're effectively working in now. And this was a new idea to them. And then one of the men said, well, the only way to do it is just to give it to one person and have him make the decision. Well, you might be able to guess what kind of church that man comes from. And the others were sort of agreeing with him. And I do believe that as we talked into that, they said, well, there's something here that we haven't seen before. And I do believe that we have something to offer to that group. I was in another group just a few years ago when a man had sinned, morally sinned. And we were talking about how he could be disciplined. And as I sat down and the other two men who were responsible for disciplining him, again, had never seen how that kind of discipline is carried out by a peer group. In such a way that we're not just getting rid of the man, but that rather we're taking a plan, a program that God himself has provided for very clearly in Scripture, and using it in such a way that the man will be disciplined, and yet disciplined and restored. Over the past 10 years, that man has been disciplined and now is restored, has a tremendous, powerful ministry. I think there are almost a majority of evangelical Christians in the United States who have never seen that take place. Their only way of really disciplining a man is just get rid of him, lock him up, never allow him back into the ministry again. They've never seen the plan that God has laid out for that kind of discipline or for that kind of ordination or for that kind of growth, holding a person accountable. The Jewish Christian churches seem to have had an advantage over the others because they understood how some of that worked. The earliest Christian churches, I believe through Paul, every place he went, he appointed presbyters, elders. And in his letter to the Corinthians, he names three classes. The apostles were the founders, the beginners, the starters. The prophets and teachers were the men who explained the scriptures and taught the people how to grow, how to apply the scriptures. But in the book called The Teaching of the 12 Apostles, that is a book, a very, very early written book. We don't know who wrote it. But that's the title of it, The Teaching of the 12 Apostles. We see the developments of a problem. Some of these leaders, elders, were becoming self-seeking. And some of them were outright frauds who had been taking advantage of people in the churches. And so tests had to be found. And the teaching of the 12 apostles, and in the writings of Hermas, the shepherd, that teaching hinged on character. They were teaching that you had to evaluate men who were going into these offices on the basis of their character. In 1 John 4 and 1 through 4, it hinged on doctrine, orthodoxy of teaching. Prophets were in Rome in the time of Hermas. We're talking about 115 to 140. In his farewell to the elders of Ephesus, Paul had warned them that this problem would arise. Talking about Acts 20 in verses 17 through 29. Take heed to yourselves and to all that flock in which the Holy Ghost hath made you bishops. Episcopus. In the first part of that, he had referred to them as presbyters, elders. But this talking to the same men in the last part of it, he referred to them as bishops. So the elders are also bishops, episcopi. The presbyteri were also episcopi. And they were to be a definite group, an office in a local congregation. The teaching of the 12 apostles, that's the book that I referred to a little bit ago. I haven't given you the full title now, but it's the 12 apostles and so forth, directs each congregation to appoint for yourselves, therefore, bishops and deacons. Despise them not, for they are your honorable men, along with the prophets and teachers. And when Clement of Rome wrote his famous letter to Corinth, to reprimand them for rebelling against the authority of their bishops and presbyters, he made it plural, and he made it interchangeable. Bishops were presbyters, presbyters were bishops, and both were plural. It wasn't that any one was over the other. Polycarp in Smyrna, writing to Philippi, the Christians in Philippi, in Philippi in 110, 117, describes the presbyters and deacons. Hermas the shepherd, writing 115 to 140, said that in Rome, the presbyters preside over the church. That's important, because there were later documents that had supposedly been written during these years which speak about the bishop of Rome. But the man who was there had not met them. Jerome insisted that the terms presbyter and bishop were interchangeable. And from about the year 100 on, every congregation had a body of presbyters or bishops with a number of deacons as their helpers. And Clement explains how they are chosen by the church, or at least with the consent of the whole church. And I'm quoting from him there. They're chosen by the church or with the consent of the whole church, end quote. Now, that's very important, because a little bit from now, we're going to be talking about the apostolic succession, and that these men got their offices simply by virtue of being appointed by those who traced their ancestry, their ecclesiastical ancestry, all the way back to Peter, who then appointed, who then appointed, who then appointed, who then appointed, and that this was the way they became bishops. Whereas what he's saying here is that they were elected by the people, at least with the approval of the whole church. Now, there has or did come to light another body of literature. And when we get down to the donations of Constantine, we'll find more of this kind of thing, and also the edicts. There was another body of literature which supposedly had been written about this same period, which promotes one of these bishops to be over all the others, to become a monarchical bishop. That was the beginning of the hierarchical system of government. Those epistles are aimed at Asia Minor and at Crete, and base themselves on Paul's letter to Titus. Whatever is not clear in these other writings is clear in Ignatius, in 110, 117, who titles himself to be a monarchical bishop of Antioch and exhorts everyone to do nothing without the bishop. And in the first report, I think it was the first report we had in this class, it was on Ignatius, and somebody had quoted from him to that effect. But he warns people, never do anything without the bishop. Always refer back to the bishop. Just like those men were saying in that business meeting just the other day, now just give it to one man, let him make all the decisions. He names the bishops in the churches in Ephesus, Trallis, I think in Philadelphia, certainly in Smyrna. He knew Polycarp. The only one he does not name is the bishop of Rome. Apparently, Rome still did not have any bishop. It's going to be very important when we begin seeing the ascendancy of Rome insofar as these other churches are concerned. But in the days of Ignatius, and he died there, he had not met the bishop of Rome, probably because there wasn't any. Ignatius was so strong on this point because he saw the bishop as the means of holding the unity of the church and of withholding the heresies, resisting the heresies. Ignatius said this, and I'm quoting from him now, "Shun divisions as the beginning of evils. Do ye all follow your bishop as Jesus Christ followed the Father and the presbyter as the apostles, and to the deacons pay respect." He's building a hierarchical system here. He does not see bishops as diocesan, that is, ruling over a number of other churches, many congregations, but it is not a new idea to him either. The idea of a monarchical bishop came into existence sometime between the time when Paul spoke to those bishops there on the sand outside Ephesus on his way back to Jerusalem, and Ignatius was writing on his way to Rome. There was a concern for the unity of the church, how to hold it all together. Now that the apostles are dying off, how are we going to hold this together? There needs to be an organization and individual men who can hold it together. There was a concern for heresies from within and from the pressures without. And a strong organization can help to do that or can do that. Probably the financial oversight and provision for the poor was also a factor in promoting men to this position of a bishop. But it was Clement of Rome in 93 to 97 who first traces the office of a monarchical bishop back up into apostolic succession. Apparently, he misunderstood what the Apostle Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 16, 15 and 16. And he was writing before Rome even had a bishop. Ignatius champions the cause of the monarchical bishop, as I said before, but he never refers to apostolic succession. He describes himself as being Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch. It was the union of these two ideas, the monarchical bishop, a bishop that is not just an equal among other bishops, but has an oversight of all of them. It was the union of that idea and apostolic succession during the second century that developed the power of the bishopric. You put those two ideas together, and that has a remarkable impact. By the sixth century, monarchical bishops were almost universal. They gained great strength during the Gnostic and Monotist and Ebionistic and struggles. Through all these heretical struggles or struggles with heresy, the position of the bishop became more and more elevated, more and more visible, more and more strong and important. By the sixth century, it was everywhere. Some say that it carried the church through and held her together through the crisis of the second century, all these heresies we've been talking about. But surely it was second best. And we are going to see as time goes along that it was sowing the seeds of dissension that later on caused a great, great deal of trouble. Now I want to go on to talk about church-state relationships between Christians and civil government, and especially the government of Rome.
Do you want
Yes, let's do. This is where your timeline will be very important. Make sure that you keep caught up. I believe that most of these names of the emperors that we're going to be talking about right now, how many pages are there in each group? Is it two pages, three pages in each one, Jack? Ben, could you help Jack then? Maybe we could pass that out for somebody. There should be three pages there. I'm going through these very, very rapidly. If you remember, this is one of the things we laid out at the beginning of the course, saying I really did want you to know who the emperors were. All we can do here is name them, and to know something about each one of them is going to be very important. I'm not saying that you're going to have on your final exam a request to tell me something about each one of these. But I'm just saying in your own understanding of these times and what was going on, it's going to be important that you would know these. At first, the Romans saw Christians and Christianity as just another branch of Judaism. And therefore, the Romans thought that it was to be protected by the Roman legions, just as they had protected the Jews and tolerated them and made provision for them, so they would tolerate this. There were the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and then there were also this body that belonged to the Jewish community called the Christians. But quarrels between the Jews and the Christians soon caused the Romans to recognize a difference. By the time of Nero, in 64, I should have asked you the date for that, 64, even Nero could see a difference between the Jews and the Christians. But the Christians were not charged with being Christians in Nero's day. What were they charged with in Nero's day? Arson. Arson. And it was easy for people to become suspicious of the Christians because they didn't use statues or idols in their worship. And so people said that they were atheists. You don't have any statue or idol. You don't believe in any God. And it was easy for Nero and others to say that the fire or the drought or the defeat or the storm or the flood or the earthquake was God's way of punishing everyone else because of these atheists who are living among us. Later on, when others began worshiping the emperors and the Christians would not, it was easy to say that those Christians are traitors. They're subversives. By the time that 1 Peter was written, and you might put the date of AD 90 that, just claiming to be a Christian was grounds for being persecuted. By the time 111 to 113, when Trajan wrote to Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, Christianity was viewed by some people as criminal, a criminal activity. But Emperor Trajan ruled moderately. Christians are not to be hunted down, he replied to Pliny. Don't hunt them out. And if they're willing to offer a pinch of salt once a year, then acquit them. Let them go. Only if they're obnoxious and resistant are they to be punished. It was an attitude of toleration towards the Christians. This was Trajan. Hadrian, 117 to 138, and Antoninus Pius followed the same general policy and discouraged mob accusations. Remember what happened with Polycarp in the arena there in Smyrna. Hadrian was discouraging that kind of thing, and so was Antoninus. Marcus Aurelius, 161 to 180, from whose reign the Roman Empire began to decline and fall. This was the time when there was a deterioration of that. He began in the year 176 to rule against all strange religions, and that included Christianity. And Marcus began persecutions, which carried on into the reign of Commodus, 180 to 192. Commodus usually was just indifferent. Commodus he was a contemptible man who just sort of gave up someplace along the line and quit being interested in anything. And that's part of the reason for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But the number of martyrs during this period seems to have been very small compared with those in the 300s and 400s. The general persecutions began around 250. We'll talk about those in just a moment. The main charges, as I said before, against the Christians were atheism and anarchy, secrecy involved in the Lord's Supper, cannibalism, gross licentiousness. In Lyons and in Vienne in the year 177, there was mob activity, the same kind of mob activity that had resulted in the death of Polycarp in Smyrna in 156. Usually, these things were handled as a police activity. The local police were in charge. Sometimes the local police were not in the business of stopping the killing, but rather of stimulating it and promoting it. You need to keep an eye on what's happening in Rome too. One out of every three people who walked the streets of Rome during these days were slaves. Huge proportion of the population were imports, slaves brought in as captives from some of the campaigns, and the nation was terribly taxed. I wish I had gone back and I've seen this before to find out how their taxing would compare to ours today, but it would have compared very well. And trade and industry were taxed to death. The leadership was getting out of the hands of the educated, and the army was recruited from outlying tribes and provinces. And after Commodus, the army controlled the choice of the next emperor. Administration was breaking down. The borders of Rome were undefended. And yet there was a growing feeling of unity and of ownership that is hard to explain. Lines of distinction were breaking down. And I'll refer to Caracalla in a few minutes. But in 212, Caracalla granted Roman citizenship to every free man in the empire, whole empire. Made him very popular, and he needed that popularity. So the second and the third centuries became an age of syncretism of all religions. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Oriental, Jewish, and so forth. I mentioned how it was that one of these emperors was a fanatical worshiper of the sun god. And he insisted that the Christians would relate to that other religion and tie in with them. The Christianity was extending through these years, the 300s and the 400s, as I showed you on the map a little bit ago, moving into the Greek-speaking communities, and beyond them into the Latin-speaking in the North Africa, and then on beyond that into Spain. 300s and 400s, as we pass into those years, are not accusing the Christians of cannibalism and of the orgies that they were before, simply because there were enough Christians around that people could know that this wasn't the kind of character that they really were. Legally, Christianity is still illegal, but usually Christians are allowed or tolerated. Commodus let the persecution he just didn't pursue it. Septimus Severus, in 193 to 211, picked it up around 202, that is the persecution. It was especially severe in Carthage. There, if you remember, that's on the northern coast of Africa. Caracalla, in 211 through 217, made it very severe in North Africa. Elagabalo, in 218 to 222, was an ardent worshiper of the sun god. He was the man who insisted on the synchronizing of the Christian Lord's Day with the word Sunday. Alexander Severus, in 222 to 235, was very friendly to Christianity. He too was a syncretist who put a bust of Christ in his private chapel along with leaders of many of the other faiths, busts of these other leaders, while his mother was sitting in on the sermons and lectures of Origen. He once decided a dispute in favor of Christians as to whether a particular shop there in Rome would become a cook shop or a place of worship. And he said, it'll be a place of worship. Maximus, in 235 to 238, ruled against the Christians. And he issued an edict against both Bishop Pontianus and his rival Hippolytus. He sent both of them to die as slaves in the mines. Probably a factor in his decision was the fact that the dispute between these two men who were vying to become bishop. They were fighting each other to become bishop. And he got disgusted with both of them and sent them off to the mines, and they died there. The persecution was worst in Eastern Asia Minor and in Palestine. But the church had rest under Gordian, 238 to 244, and Philip the Arabian in 244 through 249 there in North Africa. As a matter of fact, there was a rumor to the effect that Philip himself had become a Christian. Origen, in 246 to 248, said persecution had let up, and it was a time of sort of peace. But the year 248 was, and this is an important factor, and it's this kind of thing that you have to be aware of as you see what the political and the Christian or church activities fit together. The year 248, does anyone know what anniversary that was? What 1,000th anniversary that was? Does anyone know what happened? You subtract that from the year 1,000, you get the year 752.
Would that be the legendary founding of Romulus?
The founding of Rome. That's it exactly. Romulus and Remus. The founding of Rome. Year 248 was the 1,000th anniversary of the founding of Rome, and it brought a revival of ancient traditions and memories. The empire was under attack outwardly from the barbarians, and she was weakened by taxes and bad government inwardly, and a riot in Alexandria, just shortly before Philip died, blamed the Christians. Some feared and blamed the Christians, who were beginning to be well organized, as being an imperium in imperio, a state within a state. And it was made up of men, many of whom would not serve in the army. Now there was nothing, it was not the pacifist movement that was clear to all Christians in all parts of the world. That was not the case. But there were, in given areas, men who would not serve in the military. Because Jesus had said to Peter, put up your sword. That was one of the favorite scriptures that they used. And he that taketh the sword shall perish by the sword. And so they would not go into battle. And there was quite a debate that raged for some time about whether it would be right, it would not be right for a man to murder or to kill. But if a man killed when he was dressed in uniform as a matter of war, then there were a number of the churches and of the areas that said, yes, that is right. But they had the policy that had been put into effect by Alexander the Great, the Ecclesians, the ones who were called out, of a man's rotating into positions of responsibility as administrator in a given city or community. And the Christians sometimes would not serve, because as judges, they would have to make a decision having to do with capital punishment. And so they would not take their turn. Some of them wouldn't go into the military, and that was irksome. That was that really irritated some of the military rulers. And some of them would not take their turn as judges, and some of them would not take their turn as I suppose we'd call them mayors today. And Origen describes this problem in some of his writings. Others said that as Rome had grown great, she'd forgotten her old gods and therefore was suffering, and she must get back and make everyone else get back to the worshiping of those old gods and the bringing of sacrifices. So the Emperor Decius in 249 to 251 and his friend Valerian in the year 250 made the edict. They ordered the systematic and universal persecution of Christians. And it was bad. You see, they were not out to kill the Christians. They were out to force the Christians to sacrifice to those old gods. Killing them just wasn't enough. They were determined to force them to sacrifice. Bishop Fabian of Rome and Bablus of Antioch and Origen were tortured and killed. Some lapsed or bought certificates saying that they had sacrificed. They hadn't sacrificed, they just buy a certificate that said they had. And it was a real temptation, because you could live as a fine Christian person all year and then in private go in before a witness and throw a small pinch of incense on the fire and get your certificate and go free for the rest of the year. And be your fine Christian testimony, and who would ever know? A real temptation. The persecution soon stopped, Decius' persecution. But then Gallus, in 251 to 253, renewed it. And then in 253, Valerian, Decius' old friend, remember? Renewed it and continued it from 253 for the next 7 years into 260. In the years 257 and 258, it was fierce. All Christian assemblies were forbidden. Valerian forbade any assembly of Christians. Churches and cemeteries were confiscated. Bishops, presbyters, deacons were ordered to be killed. Lay ministers were disgraced, banished, and their properties forfeited. Cyprian died in Carthage. Bishop Sixtus II and Deacon Laurentius in Rome died. Bishop Fructose in Spain died. From 250 to 259, it was very, very, very severe. In 260, Valerian himself was captured by the Persians, the barbarians. From 260 to 268, his son, Gallienus, was a weak, incompetent ruler. He just quit fighting, Christians or anyone. Church property was returned, but the old laws were unrepealed. And this continued until Diocletian began the persecution all over again in the year 303. Diocletian, in 303, began slowly by weeding the Christians out of his army and out of the imperial palace service. But in February of 303, he issued three edicts. First, the churches were ordered to be destroyed. Second, the sacred books were taken to be burned. And third, the clergy were imprisoned and forced by torture to sacrifice. In 304, a fourth edict ordered all Christians to offer sacrifices. And many Christians under those circumstances lapsed. But popular feeling was now with the Christians because they were better known. And people just recognized their character. And they were sympathetic with them. And severity depended upon how well the local magistrate would enforce it. In Italy, it was cruel. And in North Africa and in the Orient. But the friendly man called Constantius Chlorus, made it much easier in Gaul and in Britain. There he destroyed the churches, all right. He obeyed the edict of his emperor, but he left the people unharmed and discovered, whether by accident or on purpose, that he became very popular with the people. And his support became very strong. Diocletian voluntarily retired in 305, and Maximian was forced to abdicate. And the persecution almost stopped in the West, but it was very severe, continuing on in the East. And when Constantius Chlorus died in 306, the garrison army in York declared his son Constantine to be emperor. And Constantine forced Galerius to submit him to him as Caesar of Gaul and Spain and Britain in the West. And Maximian's son, Maxentius, defeated Severus, made himself Caesar of Italy and North Africa. And then you know the story of how in 311 Constantine, Galerius, and Licinius issued an edict of toleration to all the Christians on condition that nothing is done by them contrary to discipline. I'm quoting Eusebius, has this in his history, that on condition that nothing is done by them, the Christians, contrary to discipline. They were to be let alone. It was an edict of toleration. Galerius was the worst persecutor, and we don't know why it was that he insisted on this edict. Perhaps because he was seeing that the persecution wasn't really accomplishing anything. The Christians were getting stronger in spite of the persecution. But it also may have been because he was sick. And just a few days after signing this edict, he died. And part of the edict was also commanding people to pray for him, especially the Christians. So now there are four of them. Constantine and Licinius agreed and worked together. Maximinus Daia, D-A-I-A, and Maxentius agreed. But after Licinius' death, Daia renewed the persecution in Asia and in Egypt. And Maxentius was not a persecutor, but he was an avowed pagan. Constantine was outnumbered by them, and he had to march to the attack, but a brilliant strategy and several successful battles brought him to face-to-face with Maxentius just north of Rome at that Mulvane Bridge over the Tiber River on the road to Rome. And October the 28th, 312, as we heard in the report the other day, Constantine defeated him. And then late in 312, Constantine made a great edict of complete freedom, absolute freedom, this time freedom of conscience. And Christianity was put on a level with every other religion in the Roman Empire, and all church property was restored. And then Constantine defeated Licinius once in 314, and Licinius hated the things that Constantine stood for, probably because he had, not only because he hated them, but because he had beaten him. And so Constantine had to whip him again in the year 323. Through all this persecution, the church had grown strong. But now the church suddenly found that she was under the control of the emperor of the royal imperial throne. But this was not the end of persecution for Christians. When Constantine died in 337, Constantinus, his son, became emperor first in the East and later emperor of all of it. And he saw Christianity as a threat. He renewed the penalty of death for some. He was an earnest defender of the Arian type of Christianity and a persecutor of others. He persecuted the pagans. So now we find that while it was the pagans who had been persecuting the Christians, now we do find in many places where the Christians are the ones who are persecuting the pagans. In 361, Julian became emperor. That is Julian the Apostate. 361 to 363, he set himself to restore the old gods of paganism. And he actually offered sacrifices himself. And he proclaimed toleration for Christianity. But then he worked in such a way as to provoke quarrels among the Christians so that they would destroy themselves. He forbade schools for Christians in order to dumb them down. He favored the Jews. He died 2 years later, and in 363, Jovian, who ruled from 363 to 64, tolerated Christianity. He forbade anything magic, and his son, Valens, 364 to 378, was emperor in the East, was much the same as his father. Worshipped as a pagan, tolerated the Christians, but really provoked controversies among them. In the West, Valentinian, 364 to 375, was fully tolerant of Christianity. And his son, Gratian, from 375 to 383, rejected the moderate policies of his father and began to enforce Christianity and to persecute the pagans. He appointed Theodosius in 379 to 395, who ruled as emperor in the East with an iron fist. Now it was mobs of Christians who were incited by monks and priests and other clergymen who were demolishing pagan temples and in some case killing the pagans. results of this persecution were both bad and good. I just want to mention this in closing. The bad results were that it killed some of the best leaders, and it narrowed the outreach and evangelism of the Christian community. It tended to leave those who remained as less evangelical leaders to a defense mentality, a ghetto mentality. that built walls of resistance and protection against the rest of the world, but not outreach to evangelize the rest of the world, even hatred, because they killed us. And so the Christian community lost much of its impetus towards evangelization. This was bad. We find that same thing taking place in the church that's gone underground in Russia. There is a resistance and a wall of resistance and suspicion between those true believers in Russia as they look at the others who come in, but also especially at those in the Orthodox Church. So there were bad results from this persecution, but there were good results because it separated the true from the false. And it made people think carefully about what they would die for, what is worth dying for. It made them be very careful about the date for Easter and whether Jesus is God or not. The word orthodoxy comes from the Greek word which means right and true. And these early Christians had something that they had received from the Christians before them, which was right and true, and they did not want to believe something that the apostles would have said was not right and true. So persecution always causes people to go back to know what the right and true is. It makes orthodoxy more orthodox. It purified them, in other words. But persecution also brings divisions. And Stalin persecuted the millions, but the Russian, I mentioned that illustration before, but the Russian patriarchs sometimes tried to win favor for the people and less persecution from Stalin by praising him as a great leader. And then when Stalin fell, the people were left with suspicions concerning the patriarchs and church leaders. And Gleb Yukinin was the man who identified the three leading Russian Orthodox men who, by their code names first, but then later on, as the three highest placed moles of the KGB in the Russian Orthodox Church. And people even in the church are looking suspiciously at the church, but certainly the church that has gone underground is looking very suspiciously, and many others also, at the Russian Orthodox Church. Then there were those who went underground during the persecutions that we've just been talking about, and they left their flocks, and could they be trusted when they came back? And there were some terrible divisions in the church, especially in Africa, over this subject. And Bishop Peter hid during the persecution. And Bishop Meletian visited his flock and managed to escape being killed. So after then, when the peace came back, the quarrel over whether to receive Bishop Peter back again actually divided the church. Tertullian, around the year 200 in North Africa, said, and I'm quoting from him, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." The early Christians collected the Acts of the Martyrs. That's another little thing that was handed around, a little thing called the Acts of the Martyrs, and passed them around, like our Fox's Book of Martyrs, so that people would know what they confessed, who they were and what they had died for. But they also warned against deranged people, machists, who preferred death to life, as though this would win heaven, guarantee it, which is a Mohammedan idea. They refused the idea that the Romans had that suicide was a noble act of a brave man. They admired the confessors who confessed and then didn't die. And as a matter of fact, as the bishops came into position in a given church or in a given diocese of more and more authority and power, the one person who could speak up back to a bishop and trim his wings was a confessor. A man who is known to have confessed Christ boldly and yet escaped death. And he was able to speak directly to the bishop and help to bring him into a position of some control. And why did Christianity spread so rapidly? Persecution. Persecution. both bad and good, but persecution. Second, the faith. The faith of the people. It was pleasing to God. It was honoring to Him. And interestingly enough, you find some of the old fathers talking about how this built families. It was honoring to parents. A faith that protected womanhood by making men faithful to one wife and responsible for his whole family. A faith that really cared for the poor and the weak and the fathers and the widow. The faith that cut through the chaos in all the other religions of the Greek and Roman world. And third, it was a clear authority of the prophets and the poets, the writers of the Old and New Testament. Shocking contrast to the speculations and confused reasonings of the mysteries and the legends. Thus saith the Lord. It was a clear note of authority that was there. And it was a refreshing, refreshing thing to many who were seeking for answers. The promise of a future life, which became so vivid and practical in the very face of the people who were being killed, at the very instant they were being killed. Their statements of confidence. Somehow the news that the tomb was empty got round, and the symbol of the cross became important. The confidence of the Christian martyrs, the tone of their funerals, their epitaphs, that was an important factor in the spread of Christianity. God's answer to the problem of personal guilt, my own need for that answer, probably helps to explain the growth of the church. The need for justice, as they saw so much injustice in the deaths of noble men, the need for a future life and justice of that. And the miracles. Galen was the greatest physician in Rome in that time, and he left us a list of the herbs that he used. And we find that not one out of 10 of those herbs would have done anyone any good. And I think probably, though, it was Tertullian's quotation from the pagan man that's the best explanation of why the church grew the way it did through these years. It was an unbeliever that Tertullian was quoting from. He said, and he just exclaimed it, "See how these Christians love one another." An exclamation of amazement. They'd offer to die for one another. They set up systems of care for the widows and orphans. They were simply obeying the command of the one who said, "A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have this kind of love for one another." I think that was probably the biggest reason for the rapid growth of the church during this period of time. Father in heaven, bless us now as we look back over the ages and see how it is that you worked in building your church. We'd ask, would you use us today in your building of your church? As you used them then, would you use us now? And we'd thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen. Books up here, and we will not be meeting next week. And we will not be meeting the week after next. So get all your papers done and all your reading ahead of time. And this is a good time to get caught up on reading that you just don't have to do in order to make a report on it.